From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Perron. While all eyes are focused on Greece and the escalating battle over how to settle its debt, a more pressing issue has arisen in China, the world's second biggest economy, and Australia's major trading partner. China's stock market is in the midst of a crash, not a correction, a crash. It's fallen nearly close to 30% in the past month, and Chinese authorities are desperately attempting to stop it to plunge. Ian Venrender is a business editor with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, and he speaks next to Kim Landers.
Well, the weird thing, Kim, is that since 2007, after the financial crisis, China's economy has been the world's best-performing economy. And you might recall that the US and Europe basically called on China after the financial crisis to rescue the world, to pump as much money into its economy as possible. That sparked a resources boom here, and it helped the global economy limp through the worst part of the recession that followed. But the Chinese stock market was an appalling performer. It was one of the worst performers during that period, whereas Wall Street and everywhere else went through the roof. What's happened, though, is as the economy has started to deteriorate, Chinese growth in the past 12 months or so, the economy has, the stock market has really picked up. And in fact, it's risen 120% since late last year. So there's been this debt-fueled splurge into stocks by ordinary Chinese punters, essentially, people off the street. You know, the old saying, when you hear the shoeshine person or the taxi driver giving you stock tips, it's time to bail out. And it seems as though that point has been reached, because in the past few weeks it has fallen dramatically.
So if everyone's now bailing out of the Chinese market, what is the government there doing to try to arrest that decline?
Well, it's becoming increasingly desperate now. There's action taken just this weekend that's passed, but the previous weekend, the government slashed interest rates, and it also made a lot more liquidity available through the economy in an attempt to buoy up the stock market. And what happened? The stock exchange fell another 12% last week. So this weekend that's just passed, they've decided to stop all new companies from floating on the exchange. There was something like 28 companies that were scheduled to list, and they've been canned. It's also got the major stockbrokers to pledge to put in around $26 billion to buy shares. So no selling and all buying. That was the way that they were trying to do it.
It's pretty remarkable intervention, but it seems that that action has been successful. It has arrested the decline, judging from the markets this morning.
Well, this morning the Shanghai market opened 8% higher, which is incredible. Unfortunately, that great rise lasted 15 minutes, and it was down to a 4% rise after that period. So, all this has really done is add to the volatility of the market in the past few weeks. There was one day last week where the Shanghai market opened up 3% down, ended up 5% higher. Massive swing during the day. And this is what's happening now. And I think you'll find that as you get more of this kind of intervention just simply doesn't work against the tide of money that wants to get out of this market.
So if the selling resumes, how concerned should Australian businesses, Australian shareholders be?
Well, China is, of course, our major trading partner. We sell huge amounts of resources there. We buy a lot of goods from there. The Chinese economy is in the midst of a massive transition. It's been trying to steer itself away from that investment-led growth that it had for years, and more into a consumption kind of economy, sort of along the lines of Australia, America and Europe. It's a very difficult process to try and engineer that from a policy point of view. Normally these things, just happen organically, but the Chinese government is trying to do it itself. And so it's having major teething problems while this is happening.
Now, property prices in China have also been under pressure. Clearly, this is an economy with some deep problems.
Well, yes. And the big problem, like a lot of developed economies, is debt. Now, we don't know the level of debt within the Chinese economy. There's a huge shadow banking industry. So every time the government attempts to try and get the debt under control through the official banks, there's this unofficial banking system that's outside the official channels, and that's funneling money left, right and centre. So we really don't know the extent of debt at municipal levels, at state level and within state-owned corporations. So it's really quite a worrying trend.
ABC business editor Ian Venrender speaking to Kim Landers. After last week's falls of the Chinese stock market, analysts are seeing what China's markets as an even bigger danger than Greece. But the country's shares surged a little bit this week. They were nearly up 8% after the massive Chinese government money injected over the weekend. But as Hui Fengte reports from Beijing, ordinary investors remain fearful of what may lie ahead.
Chinese retirees make a day out from a trip to the local brokerage. They trade market gossip in between munching on steamed buns and sipping tea. The mood is remarkably different from a month ago. This time, there's fear about how much more China's main stock market in Shanghai will plunge after it fell by 30% in just a few weeks. I'm just passing by. I don't play the market because I'm terrified, said one elderly investor as he walked away from us. One of his friends, who identified himself as Mr. Dong, says he's never seen anything like this before. The trend of the market is too extreme, he says. It is impossible to gauge how the market will move based on past standards. You can only observe the market because there are no standards. The market has Chinese characteristics. Suddenly, an elderly woman walks out of the brokerage shouting. The group of retirees around us say she's become mentally unstable after losing her money in the stock market when it went from boom to bust between 2007 and 2008. This time around, there have also been dramatic stories about the market crash. Chinese regulators say they are cracking down on rumors of people committing suicide. They are also investigating concerns the market is being manipulated because the exact cause of the dramatic plunge is not clear. Margin calls are also being blamed for the nosedive because its frenzied rise has been fueled by borrowed money. Independent macroeconomic analyst Andrew Collier believes the fall is happening because Chinese investors and traders are driven by short-term gains.
And even some of the institutional money managers are very short-term. Some of them are, unlike in the States, you have to look at your book every week or every a quarter or sometimes every year. In China, you could even every day you're supposed to know exactly what you're making. So they're all very trading oriented. And they're not concerned with, you know, the fundamentals. They know the fundamentals aren't there. They're just concerned with, you know, is there going to be enough money to prop up the market short term? So there's a real sense that, you know, if things look good, they'll all pile in. If things look bad, they'll all pile out. And now they're all piling out.
China's government, regulators, and financial institutions are desperately trying to stem the bleeding. Interest rates have been cut, and over the weekend, top Chinese brokerages also pledged to spend at least 21 billion Australian dollars buying shares. Tom Rafferty from the Economist Intelligence Unit says the company is not revising its GDP forecast for China because of current market performance.
The economy has been slowing, but the stock market's been rising up. That means that the correlation between stock market performance and the economy is not a very strong one. So I think the best case scenario is that the flow-on effects from this will be quite limited and contained.
The roller coaster ride that is the Chinese stock market may not be over for the country's 90 million investors. Be prepared for a stomach-lurching experience.
Hui Fengte reporting from Beijing. There are fears Australian workers will be excluded from jobs as the free trade agreement with China allows for a flood of foreign workers into the country. The Manufacturing Workers Union has begun a media campaign to highlight concerns about a section of the deal that would allow the importation of workers for some major projects without the need for labour market testing. The Trade Minister has moved to reassure Australians that local workers won't miss out on jobs, and he is questioned about the timing of the campaign. Bill Birtles reports.
It was hailed as a history-making deal by Prime Minister Tony Abbott during the signing in Canberra last month. Lower tariffs and greater access for Australian exports to China characterised an agreement that was 9 years in the making. But it's the increasing ease of access to Australia for Chinese companies that has the Australian Workers and Manufacturing Union worried. New South Wales Secretary Tim Ayres.
This deal will mean that on very ordinary construction projects in our cities and our suburbs, that an investment of just 15% will allow the company to import Chinese workers at lower wages and conditions, denying young construction workers and young apprentices the opportunity for work.
His union has hit the airwaves, trying to target blue-collar workers.
Why has Tony Abbott signed a free trade agreement that lets investors from China bring in their own construction workers on lower rates of pay?
Construction workers for real estate projects wouldn't actually be affected, but in many other sectors of the economy, the FTA does contain a provision that allows a developer to bring in temporary workers from China without the need to test the labour market first. Under what's known as an investment facilitation arrangement, so long as there's a substantial Chinese interest in a major infrastructure project, temporary workers can be brought in.
This is purely and simply a xenophobic scare campaign designed to distract attention away from the Royal Commission into union corruption.
The Trade Minister, Andrew Robb, says the agreement isn't designed to allow Australians to be bypassed for jobs.
What it does is ensure that if there is a multi, you know, million, hundreds of millions or billions of dollar project, which may take a year or two to design and get ready before construction, that the companies have the certainty, if they sign up to one of these agreements, what it says is that if and when you are ready to start this project, if there's a shortage of certain sorts of skills, maybe they want 30 types of welders that aren't available at the time, they've got to prove that they're not available in Australia, then they will, over a short period of time, be allowed to bring in suitably qualified welders.
Temporary Chinese labour has been a driving force behind many major infrastructure projects in developing countries, particularly in Africa. But a specialist in Chinese investment research, Hans Handrischke from Sydney University's Business School, says hundreds of Chinese workers toiling on a project site here isn't quite as likely.
During the mining boom, of course, the idea from the Chinese side was that they would be able to reduce costs quite considerably by bringing in Chinese labour. Of course, now that is not really the major issue anymore. I don't see at the moment any big projects where it's quite likely that they would try to bring in labour. And I think their intention was to actually bring in more specialised, more technical personnel than actual labour.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Shocking images of Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar stranded at sea have begun being beamed around the world in recent weeks, highlighting the plight of the long-persecuted group. There have been images, too, of abandoned people smuggling camps in the Thai-Malaysian border, where mass graves of Rohingya have been exhumed. Our South Asia correspondent, Samantha Hawley, traveled to the border to report the story, and she says she was shocked at what she found.
Sometimes, as a correspondent, a story comes to you, and sometimes you have to work very hard to get to it. This is a case of the latter. Myself, the ABC producer in Bangkok, and cameraman had flown to Thailand's deep south on a mission to reach the border and cross over into Malaysia. There, authorities were exhuming mass graves of Rohingya Muslims who died at people smuggling camps, and we wanted to see it. The problem was we arrived not knowing exactly how we were going to do that. A four-wheel drive could take us only so far, and then it was time for a jungle trek. We're stopped by Thai soldiers who then agree to walk us to the border.
He said when we go up here, that is the left, we have to turn left and go up there. That's where the Malaysian going up.
Okay. And it's not an easy trek in the dense jungle region. The mosquitoes get us first. The DEET could also be used as a paint stripper, but it keeps them away. Then there's the heat. At 40 degrees, it's debilitating. Add to it an almost vertical mountain climb, and it becomes a tough day at the office. Once we reach the border, we know there's no way we can walk to the other side without being arrested. The Thai soldiers won't allow us to cross the barbed wire. We make our way back down. None of us know, but very soon we'll be making a discovery that will shock us. We trek up again, this time at a slightly different angle. It's there we reach an abandoned people trafficking camp. Nazi Germany springs immediately to my mind. This is how I described it to the camera shortly after we arrived.
This really is a shocking scene, something that you really can't believe, that people were living in conditions like this. There's still a stench around this camp, and that 1,000 people were living here at one time is unbelievable. They were living clearly like animals, and there's evidence of men, women and children, young children living in these conditions. It really is just horrifying.
The camp has been abandoned for about a month, but we see evidence that torture took place and that the Rohingya victims who were trafficked there were locked in bamboo cages. To the side, the grave site proves that disease and starvation was rife. After some time, we hike down again with a new perspective of the suffering in the jungles and of the stateless Rohingya from Myanmar. And our conversation turns to how lucky we are. Sometimes television is hard to make and easy to watch. Sometimes it's hard to make and hard to watch. I hope this time it's the latter.
A close advisor to Japan's prime minister says the government in Tokyo is willing to be more flexible if it wins the lucrative $20 billion contract to build Australia's next fleet of submarines. In a speech to ANU's National Security College, Professor Takeshita Shinohige says he is foreshadowing a bigger military role for Japan in the region and announced it will soon train Coast Guard officials for ASEAN neighbors. The professor predicts there'll be more Australian and Japanese military training exercises in the near future. He speaks next to our national security reporter, Andrew Green.
There are a number of things we can do together. For example, in capacity building and also on defense equipment and technology collaboration. I now understand that there are quite a lot of areas in which we can actually mutually help each other.
Japan is for the first time this year participating in the Talisman Sabre training exercises. Mm-hmm. Could you eventually see a day where Japanese troops do permanent rotations through Australia?
Yeah, this is a very important first step. Even though the Japanese contingent is embedded and also quite small, I would say that I hopefully see this contingent expand so that actually we can learn how to exercise together with Australian troops.
Can you envisage some form of confrontation in the South China Sea or East China Sea in the next couple of years?
It actually depends on what you mean by confrontation. I mean, something like the confrontation which happened last year from May to July between China and Vietnam can happen anytime. That means short of military action. But China, as well as ASEAN countries, and of course Japan, the United States, will be very cautious to proceed to any sort of action which might be construed as even remotely military.
If I could turn to the issue of submarines, which is dominating defence discussion in Australia, is it in Japan's security interest to be exporting that secure technology and giving away those secrets?
Well, first of all, let me tell you, I mean, if the Japanese government agrees to work with the Australian government on developing this submarine technology together, it really shows how much trust we have in Australia, not only the government, also Australian public. And certainly we are very much aware this is a major decision on the part of Australian government as well as the public and industry. And therefore, we need to make sure that this is acceptable to Australian industry too.
Do you think there is the willingness in Japan to part with those secrets or sensitive technological information?
Yes, I think so. I mean, actually, I'm very much aware, and I think, you know, defense people are very much aware that there is a very strong political will at the very top of the government to make this happen.
This would be the first time that Japan has exported this sort of technology.
Exactly.
Do you believe your country has the shipyard capacity to be building for export?
Well, that part, I don't know. The Ministry of Defense is doing is to come up with an institutional mechanism to make this happen. All this, you know, building new shipyard, what kind of task share be devised between Australia and Japan and so on, can only be decided on after this institutional design is in place.
Do you believe there would be any flexibility in Japan being able to build a majority of the submarines in Australia as requested by people in South Australia?
I mean, as I said, we are very much aware that this is very important, not only to the Australian government and military, but also to Australian industry and the public. And therefore, I mean, I assume that there are willingness to negotiate, but I mean, how much, I don't know.
Japan is grappling with a recent and troubling problem in which hundreds of thousands of people have become recluses. Estimates suggest that up to 1 million Japanese people, mostly men, have withdrawn from society, locking themselves in their bedrooms and refusing to come out. It might sound like a fairly standard adolescent behavior if it didn't last, not for weeks or months, but for years. Not only is the condition shattering families, but is also threatening Japan's economy. Matthew Carney reports next from Tokyo.
For nearly 3 years, Yuto Onishi's world was his small bedroom. He slept during the day and lived at night, trawling the internet and reading comics. Yuto refused all contact with friends and family, sneaking out only in the dead of night to eat. The Japanese call the condition hikikomori.
Once you experience the hikikomori lifestyle, you lose reality. I knew it was abnormal, but I didn't want to change. It felt safe here.
In junior high, Yuto had failed as a class leader, and to cope with the shame and judgment from others, he withdrew. For Yuto, and as many as 1 million Japanese, the pressure from families and society is too much to bear. Dr. Takahiro Kato is one of the few hikikomori experts in Japan.
In Western societies, if one stays indoors, they're told to go outside. In Japan, they're not. Our play has changed. It's all on screens and not real-life situations anymore. There's cultural reasons also, a strong sense of embarrassment and emotional dependence on the mother.
The causes and treatment are little understood, but Dr. Kato is determined to stop the next generation of Japanese boys locking themselves in. He's leading a team from Kyushu University to decipher the condition.
Most case studies have only focused on the psychological aspect, but hikikomori is not just about mental illness. We're working on the social and biological aspects as well, and want to be the first to provide a multidimensional diagnosis.
The road to recovery for hikikomori can be a long one, and the longer one stays in their room, the less likely they are to make it out. Dr. Kato says recovery can only be successful if the dynamics of family interactions change, and that means the whole family has to be involved in counselling. Then the first steps are to rebuild communication and trust. Yuto Onoshi has been out of his room for 6 months. The dream of travelling and working overseas forced him out. Early intervention worked for him.
Facing your trauma is horrifying. It's hard to do. If you can do it with someone else, then they can show you a different vision of the future.
Yuto is on the road back, but the pressing reality for Japan is that most hikikomori remain in their rooms. This is Matthew Carney reporting in Tokyo.
At any given time, there are more than 100,000 people in Australia considered homeless. A quarter of those are under the age of 18. And in Brisbane, there's a sudden increase of young teens from the suburbs sleeping rough on the city streets. Queensland is one of two states which haven't yet signed up for the National Partnership Agreement on Homelessness. Elise Worthington spent a night on the streets in Brisbane, hearing how domestic violence and drug use are adding to the problem. Take mass effects.
It's 9 o'clock in Brisbane's CBD and these kids are settling in for the night. Brisbane Youth Service workers Jesse Nolan and Shannon Faulkner are mingling with the locals.
It's alright, hey, Sarah's been trying... What's your phone number?
Who's Sarah?
The pair spend two nights a week on the streets trying to connect young people with services.
Even if you go to Ipswich
one. I just said...
Hey, this is Elise.
Hello, this is Trey. Welcome to BYS, lovely.
Jesse has been trying to find 18-year-old Trey for weeks.
So Trey is a young Indigenous man who identifies as homosexual and intermittently transgender. So Trey also has a couple of diagnoses around schizophrenia, autism.
I love music, I love dancing, I love singing. I know the city off by heart ever since I was 14, so I know the ins and outs, the trouble I can get into.
Trey fled to the streets to escape a violent home.
It was because of family and domestic violence, so that's the sort of stuff I don't want to see in my life anymore.
But Jesse says the streets have taken their toll on him too.
We've seen him be pretty significantly assaulted, engage in sex work with some of the older homeless community.
You don't know nothing about me, little dog.
A few minutes later, Trey gets in a fight with a younger teenager.
You want me to spit in your face and kill you?
Come in, me.
The police are called to break it up.
Junkies, gum like you.
Junkie bash.
Youth workers like Jesse say they've seen an influx of kids on Brisbane streets over the past few months.
We had about anywhere between sort of 30 and 60 young guys from the outer suburbs coming in. And we found that this group of young guys have stayed in the city a bit longer. We don't want them to really get stuck or entrenched in that circle of homelessness.
And how young are these kids that are sleeping on the street?
The youngest kid that we've seen is 13.
How old were you the first time you slept out?
I was actually 12 to 13. It was actually a bit scary and stuff. Like, I didn't really know much people, and you know, it was a bit cold that night, so I was kind of had nowhere else to go. There's actually more younger kids coming on. You know, we're just trying, us old school, you know, streets, we're all just trying to help them out and say it's not a good idea.
Jesse Nolan says they're also dealing with more teenagers smoking ice.
Young people are going straight from not really using at all substances to spending a couple nights on the street and then starting to use ice.
Youth worker Shannon Faulkner says it's a habit that's sometimes encouraged by the older homeless teens.
They'll start feeding it to them, which is helping them make money, which is causing, I guess, the sort of generational stuff happening with the ice use.
Shannon and Jesse will help you along the way.
For now, 18-year-old Trey says he wants to stay out of trouble.
Life's, like, you know, rough and tough, but you end up like me, being on the streets at a very young or old age. Just expect the unexpected. That's all I got to say. Thank you.
And with that report from Elise Worthington, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you want to contact us, our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. From everyone at the PCJ Radio International Newsroom, I'm Keith Pallon wishing you well. Thanks so long. Take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.